All right, well, good morning also. Thank you for being here and for your interest in this very timely topic, very timely and important topic that will affect all of our futures because if our kids aren't graduating, I don't know about you, but I'm very concerned about who's going to take care of me later on, you know? So I need them to graduate and contribute to society, and I need them and to contribute to the economy. So I personally and professionally, it is a very critical issue for me that I am very, very concerned about. So I, too, have no financial commercial relationships to disclose. And what I'd like to do is offer just one strategy. Now, there's lots of strategies out there. I happen to believe this strategy offers a very comprehensive approach, and that's school-based health centers, and I'll share with you why. And but I'm not here to say that that's the only one, because there are others. And I'm going to, we'll have an opportunity to talk a little bit more about this, because we did offer maintain time for discussion and for us to generate some other ideas. So this is what I intend to cover, and I'm going to move as quickly as possible so that we have time for that discussion. First of all, just an overview on school-based health centers. They provide quality, comprehensive care. Many physical and mental health care services tend to be the fundamental basic services. Some are also doing vision and oral health care as well. They help students succeed not only in school but in life. They're located in or near a school facility and are open minimally during school hours. Many of them extend beyond school hours, and there are even a few that are open on Saturdays or periodically on Saturdays and or even in the evenings to accommodate the broadest range of young people and the lives that they have to live. It's usually organized through schools, communities, and health provider relationships, including local health departments. And many of them even receive local health department funding, state health department funding, and as well as private dollars and reimbursement from third-party payers. They're staffed by qualified healthcare professionals, and I was just talking to someone this morning who said to me that there's still this belief that they're not that the people who provide care in school-based health centers are not qualified and that they are providing subpar care. When I heard it this morning, I didn't know we were still fighting that misinformation out there. So they provide, I'm saying it to you, and I hope you'll say it to others as an advocate, that they are qualified healthcare professionals, typically nurse practitioners and or physician assistants who are supervised by physicians in concert with sometimes the school nurse, as well as a medical assistant. So it's just, and some have framed it as like a doctor's office in a school building. And one of the things critical about them is they focus on the prevention, early identification, and treatment of medical and behavioral health concerns that can interfere with the student's learning. About approximately 2 million children across the country receive their health care through school-based health centers right now. This is a map that shows you basically the distribution of school-based health centers. There's more than 1,900 clinics and programs that are connected with schools nationwide. And this is taken from a census that is conducted every 3 years. So this data is a little bit dated. It's the 07-08 census that was taken. And right now, the census data from 10-11 is being analyzed right now and will be released next year. But as of this particular census that was released, the data that was released in 09, there are about 1,900. They're in 43 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. They're primarily located in geographically diverse communities, with the majority of them, 57%, in urban communities and about 27% in rural areas. The physical location of the school-based health center is most often in the school building. But in some cases, they're on the school campus, but not in the actual school building. And in other cases, they are linked down the street, around the corner, with a relationship, a formal relationship to that school. The census that's being analyzed right now will be counting school-linked programs and centers as well. So we'll have a better feel for both mobile programs and linked programs in the next census report. In terms of the schools with school-based health centers, About 39% are in schools with largely Hispanic or Latino students, and 26% with black students. So almost 56% are located in schools with largely predominantly minority students. But one of the things I do want to make sure I pull out here, emphasize here, is that these are the populations who have historically experienced health inequities, including being underserved, uninsured, underinsured, and poor health as adults, and the same ones that end up showing up in the dropout data. In fact, they tend to even be attending schools that are considered dropout factories. So what do we know about school-based health centers? Is everything okay? Okay. What do we know about school-based health centers? So here's some of the evidence of school-based health centers on prevention, on primary care, and mental health. They are experts in managing risky behaviors and dangerous health outcomes associated with adolescents, although I don't want you to think that they're limited to high schools. They do exist in elementary schools, middle schools, and combination schools, K-8 scenarios as well, middle schools or junior high schools. There's lots of different configurations. However, the majority are in high schools, but it's not exclusive to high schools. The utilization of school-based health centers results in greater reduction in asthma-related emergency room visits as well as hospitalization costs. That's been documented in the literature, and we've provided some references for you that you have access to near the end of this presentation, or you can also go on our website and find extensive articles on the research that has been done around school-based health centers, which is a new and budding area in terms of documenting the impact, but we're delighted that it exists. You can also go to the book that Leslie referenced earlier, the School-Based Healthcare, that's been published by the American Public Health Association, because some of the results are in there, as well as the American Journal of Public Health September 2010 issue. Also has several articles that have been codified about the impact of school-based health centers and the Journal on School Health. So we have research that's coming forward to support this particular model and give us the kind of data in that second bullet. They are very effective in reaching racial minorities and in particular young men who typically do not use healthcare services and most importantly are beginning the behavior of using healthcare services. So when they're adult men, which we know we have a huge issue in our society about adult men utilizing preventative care services, starting that behavior as a teenager or as a middle schooler, we're beginning to lay the pathway for adult behavior. Very, very important. And also in facilitating services such as mental health care, risk assessments, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more, and early intervention. A little bit different than a doctor's office, which typically kids go, parents take up when they're sick. In a school-based health center, they can be identified a little bit earlier and early intervention and prevention strategies put into place. Some of the additional evidence is that adolescents were 10 to 21 more times more likely to come to a school-based health center for mental health services than a community health center network or HMO. Students, teachers, and parents who have a school-based health center rated academic expectations, school engagement, safety, higher than in schools without a school-based health center. And we've also found that the presence of a health center positively impacts the overall school climate and learning environment. Okay. And most importantly, to talk specifically about what Leslie said, health and education are two sides of the same coin. We have found that users of school-based health centers had a decreased absenteeism rate, decreased tardiness, increased grade point average, and African-American males were 3 times more likely to stay in school. Now, when you compare that to the dropout data, that's rather impressive and makes a case for why this should be considered one of the strategies to impact dropout. Then when we look at some of the social determinants of health and the impact of school-based health centers, because this is not just about clinical care. This is about meeting kids' needs, and many of them are social. And you ask any teacher, and he or she can tell you the social issues that kids are coming into his or her classroom with every single day, and that he or she feels like she doesn't know what she can do about it, she doesn't have time to do it, or doesn't have the expertise to do it. So it's very important for us to pay attention to these social determinants, and that's what we do in public health. We do know, for example, that school-based health centers improve access to health care. It's simplified simply by the fact that it's in the school. So those barriers are eliminated, not only for the youngster, but also for parents who might have to leave work or leave other children at home in order to take care of the health care needs. We know that it affords the opportunity to intervene with adolescents engaged in risky behaviors early and avert poor health outcomes during their youth. Many of these problems can begin the trajectory for longer-term chronic health problems, which is probably why Healthy People 2020 included that particular objective around the chronic illness and how can we make an impact earlier, as well as the impact that staying in graduation has on overall adult health and adult risk behaviors. So essentially, school-based health centers can also influence policies that affect all students so that they can be well and learn. And I want to give you one example about of an instrument that's used. I'm going to go through it very quickly, but I want to share with you how it can be used to identify those risks and avert them from manifesting into the clinical conditions that not only impact health, but also educational achievement. So there's a particular instrument out there called RAPS, Rapid Assessment for Adolescent Preventive Services. Anybody in here heard of it before? Okay, very good. So it's out there. If you Google it, you'll find it, or I'm going to give you the website at the end if you're interested to learn more. Anyway, this particular instrument assesses the majority of health problems among adolescents that are due to risky behaviors rather than biological dysfunction, which is very important in adolescents, and actually I'm talking about adolescents, but it also goes down to middle school and is being created for elementary school as well. It's a little different than Bright Futures, which probably many of you have heard about, because it's looking at risk behaviors, not conditions, but it's specifically looking at, and also because it's self-administered. It also recognizes that the primary causes of premature death and injury are preventable in nearly 75% of the adolescent population. It correlates very nicely with YRBSS, if you're familiar with that, Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System. And we also know that almost 3/4 of adolescent mortality is a result of motor vehicle crashes, homicide, suicide, and unintentional injuries. Point being, they're preventable conditions that and can be identified if we look at the risk behaviors, and that's what RASPS does. It's youth-friendly, it's self-administered in less than 10 minutes, which data has shown that young people answer questions more honestly when it's self-administered than when a clinician, a parent, or a counselor asks them the same exact question. Okay? It's web-based. And therefore electronic and can be easily connected, and it's compatible with electronic health records or electronic medical records, which all providers are going to have to be moving to by 2014, as we know, through the Affordable Care Act. Standardized, it's scientifically validated, and in the student self-administering it, there are a number of subtle health messages that they are receiving as they're self-administering this particular assessment. It has been designed in response to health literacy issues. It identifies individual risk behaviors as well as can be aggregated to identify the population risk, which we in public health, that's what we're interested in and most concerned about. Some of the sample questions that young people are answering through RAPS are as follows. Have you ever carried a weapon to protect yourself? In the past few months, have you smoked cigarettes or any other form of tobacco? In the past 12 months, have you driven a car drunk, high, or while texting? In the past 3 months, have you drunk more than a few sips of alcohol or beer? Now, you have a parent or a provider ask them any of those questions, and what do you think the answer is going to be? Okay, but when they do it self, when they answer it themselves, you know, you're more likely to get more accurate and valid results from it. During the past month, have you been threatened, teased, or hurt by someone? Have you ever had any type of sex? If you have had sex, do you always use a method to prevent sexually transmitted infections, pregnancy, etc.? The benefit, and it goes on, I just gave you, pulled out a sample of questions. Right now it's about 21, and it's under 8-10 minutes. And most importantly, young people, a group of young people have used participated in the creation of the instrument so that the language is youth friendly. Okay, they're not terms that you and I understand, and it goes right over their head. For example, they required that when you say, have you used alcohol, you can't say alcohol because they think of alcohol as hard liquor, quote, vodka, gin, rum. They don't consider beer or wine alcohol, okay, or some of those, wine coolers. They don't consider those things alcohol. So when you just say you drink alcohol, based on what they consider alcohol will determine the answer. So one of the benefits of that particular instrument is the fact that they participated in its creation. And the risks are manageable at the individual level. So once they complete this, it goes right into the clinical encounter. So the clinician can then address any of the issues that have been brought up. It goes into the clinical record, so follow-up can occur after the intervention, so it can be managed at the individual level for professional providers. But what's equally important is that you can aggregate this data and you can do population-based prevention and intervention programming, such as education, services, or support. So, for example, if you see the majority or a substantial percentage of ninth grade girls, because it is confidential, so identifiers has been removed from it and in the aggregate form. But you can still look at ninth grade, 10th grade, 11th grade. You can look at gender. So if you see ninth graders, a significant proportion coming in, haven't had sex, and they're not using protection, you know what's going to happen shortly, and you can really hone in on that population from a public health perspective in terms of primary prevention and using that data and then monitor it from year to year. You can even use it as a surveillance system. It's a work in progress. There's additional questions, for example, around homelessness, around breakfast, around electricity. These are all social determinants that have to do not only with health, but educational. You can't do homework or study if you didn't have electricity last night. Okay, and that's real for kids, for a large percentage of our kids in urban environments. And we know they start falling behind, and then you start the sequela that leads to dropout. Okay, it's not rocket science here. Anyway, if you want more information about RAPS, that's the website. I just wanted to show you an example of school-based. This is an instrument that's, for example, being used in school-based health centers throughout Michigan. Okay, right now. And in other states around the country, Colorado has a few using it, Oregon has a few using it, but through Michigan, it's pretty much uniformly being used. So social determinants of educational success, the social circumstances associated with educational success include food and housing, which RAPS, the new version, will get to. Social experiences associated with graduation, school violence, as well as unplanned pregnancy are a couple of the examples, and RAPS identifies the risk behaviors associated with that. And then to just go over real quickly, how am I doing on time?
You're good.
Okay.
You're fine.
What a colleague of ours, some of you may be familiar with him, Chuck Bash identifies, this is another example of what he identifies as the seven conditions that contribute to academic underachievement, particularly in urban minority students. This comes out of the journal School Health Fall Supplement, October 2011, where he identifies specifically for urban minority youth, these particular conditions are the ones that are contributing mostly to their underachievement. And we know, again, underachievement is an indicator. Heads you right down the pathway for dropping out of school. And so if we can focus in on these areas, because every single one of these we can remedy. We can either manage or remedy them in some way, shape, or form. And so we're deliberate and intentional about focusing on dropout prevention, which is what Healthy People 2020 now gives us the platform to do as public health practitioners. We can certainly even hone in on very specific conditions and be very laser-like and focused about our approach, especially when you're in a school-based health center and you can bring in a very comprehensive approach. And that's what the center that I'm the director of is about. This is the model that we're espousing. You have it in the folder that was left at the door for you so you can read it a little more carefully. I just want to explain it very quickly, that this model proposes to expand the role of school-based health centers to adopt a population-based approach, so for the school-wide population. So you're not just looking at the kids who come in the health center. You want to look at those, because certainly that's the primary role of a school-based health center. But if you think about breaking down the walls, the clinic walls, and moving to the entire student population, thinking about doing an assessment, which is one of the things we in public health do, right? Over in that green circle there, assessment, planning, intervention, and evaluation. You use an instrument such as RAPS or whatever instrument you want to use. I'm very committed to that for very specific reasons. But if you wanted to use another instrument, that's fine. The point is to have the data. We have some YRBS data and there's other school data that can be put together. That's what we do. We look at the data from an epidemiological perspective, and then we think about the strategies that can either prevent or intervene early on with those particular issues. The school-based health center model that we're espousing would focus in on the conditions that are related to kids dropping out of school, underachieving and dropping out of school. That's the focus we're saying. We already know that they do physical, mental, oral, vision, and they bring in community services or refer to community services, which I don't like the word refer because kids don't, they just cannot. I mean, you send the kid upstairs to clean their room, and how do they make it? I mean, just think about it. You know, you send him or her upstairs to clean. How many times do you have to tell them, go clean your room? But we expect that same teenager to take a referral and go follow through on the referral somewhere else. You know, I think it's an unreasonable expectation for teenagers. Their brains don't operate that way. They just simply don't operate that way. We like to think they're little adults, and sometimes they look like adults, but in reality, cognitively, they're not adults. But we expect that of them, and I suggest to you that that's a disservice that we're doing them when we refer them, unless we have a real strong follow-up component. So anyway, I'm a believer of on-site services. That's my bias. With regards to these highly vulnerable kids that I'm talking about. School-based health centers can also be advocates in these other areas. For example, Leslie spoke to physical activity. We know that teen pregnancy is a big issue, bullying, school violence, as well as hunger and obesity. For some kids, substance abuse is a huge issue as well. And then we know that school-based health centers can also, with careful planning and strategizing, can address the issues around nutrition, reproductive health, life skills, wellness, etc., and bring all the resources together, including school nurses, school counselors, in the school building, as well as orchestrate resources from outside the building, community resources, to become a part of the strategy to prevent kids from dropping out of school. And that's the model that we're advocating out of the Center for School Health and Education at the American Public Health Association. I think the bottom line is having them, school-based health centers, to begin to recognize the role they can play in the educational success of kids more deliberately and intentionally. And breaking down the barriers between health and education and our partners in education. Finally, let me end with this opportunity that we have, that graduation, that you can't educate people that are not healthy, but you certainly can't keep them healthy if they're not educated, from Dr. Joyce Lynn Elders. And so this is an opportunity that we have in public health right now with that particular objective, and we want to spend some time talking through that about what's going on in the community and what you can do
and or what we might do after this.
So thank you. And is this question time? Okay.
So we'd love to entertain your questions. Are there any questions? Yes.
Would either of you speak to issues of, how do I say this, financially sustaining such clinics? Certainly in Flint, I've talked with some of our local people there, and that's always a question in terms of, you know, how do you, I mean, I don't hear many people questioning the value of having a school-based health center. The issues I hear are, where do you get the funding for this? How do you, you know, sustain this from a business model? Do you have, you know, clinics set up and yet they don't have the volume of students coming to be able to sustain it? What's the financial model for those kind of barriers?
Okay. So the financial model is, there's one being created right now around it about what it would take, and that would vary from city to city. But I just, in fact, had a conversation this morning via telephone with the organization that's working, who's spending a lot of time on establishing that model so that we have some data that talks about what will it take and what are the different strategies to meet that. But what a couple of things we do know that have helped it along. Has it fixed it? No. Has it helped it along? Absolutely. Right after President Obama was signed into, was inaugurated, he reauthorized the Child Health Insurance Program. And in the Child Health Insurance Program, school-based health centers are recognized. Okay, that's the first recognition in a federal policy ever. Ever. That's a step in the right direction, because we weren't even there before. Now we're there. Secondly, in the Affordable Care Act, resources were provided to at least to start the discussion around infrastructure and construction and the getting school-based health centers ready to participate in 2014 when electronic health records become mandatory. Because you won't even be able to bill if you don't have electronic capacity in 2014. So those resources that were provided in the Affordable Care Act, which the fact that we were even mentioned in the Affordable Care Act, for those of you who've been involved in school-based health as long as I have, you know that that is monumental, monumental to even be included in there. We were afterthought in the past. Now at least we're a part of the conversation. Okay, those are doors opening up. And so the provision is there, and the advocacy now is around operations money to be included in the act as well. Okay, and then what we see happening is as kids are required to have a medical home, that then will provide another way to increase the volume. So we're not trying to make it so that school-based health centers are seeing kids for 10 minutes. We're not trying to do that. With all due respect to doctors' offices, we're not trying to do that, all right? Because these kids have special needs and are challenged in very distinctive ways, and we don't want school-based health centers to ignore that because they have to see a certain number of patients in an hour. That's not what we're talking about here. We want the model to remain authentic to what it was all about in the first place. So becoming the medical home is a very critical strategy that the advocacy group in D.C. is working for it to happen. My caution around that is how that medical home gets defined. And if it's just based on a medical clinical model, I'm a little bit concerned about that. If it's based on a social medical model, then the strategy could be potentially rewarding to school-based health centers, okay? And then, of course, with portable records, then if the kid moves from school to school, that's one of the challenges, is they move, they're homeless, and they're moving from school to school, and so the medical record needs to follow that kid, and we will be able to do that with electronic records. More and more school-based health centers are billing, and they are also looking for administrative match, so they're not just doing the fee-for-service billing, but they're also access an administrative match. And there's a piece on my website that talks extensively about administrative match of Medicaid dollars. Okay? And then there was one more. There's also some work around bundling, because the fee for service model does not, I know it's a long answer, y'all, but it's not a simple question, okay? There's also some work occurring around bundling reimbursement for school-based health centers, not because the fee-for-service model will never pay for what they do, ever. It's always going to fall short. So you have to look at a different strategy. And one of those strategies that will be is being discussed in the business model, is maybe it's a different structure for reimbursement, particularly around a medical home. Maybe it's a capitation around being the medical home for a kid enrolled in a school. So what I'm saying to you essentially is that we're not there yet. I mean, we just got in the federal conversation in 2009. Okay, so we've made wonderful progress in a very short amount of time. But there's work being done, because that is an issue a global issue around school-based health centers is sustainability. And so I've even seen, and this is something that those of you who operate them or fund them can consider, where they are even seeing adults during non-school hours, right? So let's say they're open to 4. Wouldn't an adult love to have access to a health center after 6 o'clock in the evening when they get off from work? Or every other Saturday, maybe? You know, the clinic is there. And unless it's a pediatric clinic where, you know, it's taking care of babies, you know, in many cases, particularly those in high schools, maybe can open their doors, especially if they have an external entrance that they can come in without walking through the school building, which schools that are being rebuilt nowadays, they are building them with external entrances so that people can come in from the community. Now, you don't want to commingle them during service time. I mean, the reason why it's an adolescent clinic is because they need to have the confidentiality for them to come. So you don't want to commingle them. But certainly if they close at 4 o'clock, for the kids, they can open at 6 o'clock with a family physician or a family nurse practitioner and see a larger population. That can contribute as well to the overall sustainability of the model, especially if they open up over the summertime. So, you know, we got to put the work in to be able to help diminish that gap in resources.
This young lady with the white hair.
I wanted to make a comment about the dropouts. We have a school-based health center in the Chicago area, and we are in a school where, like, we've had, you know, 6 superintendents and like 7 principals in 10 years. So every school year, it's a new cast of characters and a new thing. But at any rate, they were doing a lot of suspending kids for any possible excuse. We kind of worked with them. They're doing some in-school suspension now. But an in-school suspension, the kids are sitting there doing nothing for, you know, 7 hours. But now our social worker is going in and doing coping skills and anger management in in-school suspension. I'm sure others are doing that. But this is brilliant, because the kids are sentenced.
Right.
To hear this, and they like it, and the kids actually say that the best part of their day in suspension when our social worker was in there saying, well, you know, tell me about this kind of thing. Right. So I mean, I haven't been slick enough to write this up yet, but it's on calendar. So publish it when we do it. But I guess sort of thinking about, you know, where are those I just have to say, school systems where our schools are screwed up. So, okay, anybody in a screwed up school, raise your hand. So what I think is we have to think creatively, and given that the system is screwed up, what can we contribute, because we're not screwed up, that we can do? So I think that's
help the kids.
And I'm going to say one other thing, is that we're in a school of nursing. There are not a lot of school of nursing sponsored school-based health centers. My other pitch is, if you are any place near a community college, a school of nursing, a university, that's the partnership you want. Mm-hmm. Schools of nursing are desperate for clinical sites, you know, and so are social work schools and stuff, so that if you can form a partnership and you can get some student nurses or student social workers or psychologists in there, you can leverage your resources. So we are blessed. So we put 91 students through our school-based health center this year, including medical students, social work students, nursing students, and then they are in classrooms doing presentations. They're helping us with our healthcare, all that kind of stuff. They like it because they need the clinical and you need the people. So that's my spiel. Diana Hatzweiler, Loyola University Chicago, my 20th year, and I haven't given up yet.
Well, you know what? Thank you very much for that, because that's actually where we would like to go. If you have questions, would you mind holding them until the end? We'd like to generate more discussion like this of ideas, solid experiences that you are having navigating partnerships with education for the outcomes that you're seeking. Oh, thank you, Terry. Go ahead.
And so I'm based in Boston, and just to address your question there, I don't know if it works for every city, but the hospitals in Boston have to have community benefits programs where they funnel funds back to the community, and it looks very different depending on the hospital. But, you know, Mass General Hospital, they have really great models of funneling that, you know, money back into youth programs. And I know there's some hospitals that have partnered with health that are affiliates of health centers, that those health centers then had satellite health centers in schools, like the one that I worked at. But I think, you know, that's an avenue if the hospitals have money. I know in Boston they generate a lot of money, so they have to give it back to the community, and it looks different. And I've been in conversations and in tables to push hospitals to think a little bit differently. So policy is the way to work. And, you know, talking to allies and those individuals that, you know, will find it beneficial. But I think hospitals are really great avenue to go to, and a lot of them have a lot of funding that they need to do something with. And I know in Boston there's some school-based health centers that are receiving funds from hospitals in the area.
Now, what is exactly is your title? What do you do?
Oh, I no longer work in school-based organizations, but I'm a senior trainer, so I train adults who work with young people. I train thousands of youth workers in the state of Massachusetts in greater New England.
Okay.
So I also get people that come to my training that work in health centers now and other things.
Okay. Yes.
One thing I just made one comment about community benefit, which is just to bring it full circle, that was one of the primary early frontier funding systems for school-based health centers were community benefit. Now the caution with that is that the money goes like this. And any other time, they can say, well, we don't want to do this this year, we're going to do this year. So you don't want to be dependent on it, but they're great to seed something, or great to demonstrate something.
Hold them accountable.
And hope,
right.
You don't want to be dependent on it, because it is so variable and precarious, depending on who's the CEO of the health system. Okay? So, sorry.
That's all right. So, yes. Yes, we couldn't agree with you more. Yes.
I come from an educational psychology background, and then I'm also in public health. And I think one of the things, really getting schools of public health and schools of education to communicate, and the professional development on the teacher side, because although schools are a great place for solutions, they also cause a lot of problems, toxic stress, just stereotypes and beliefs about what students can do. So I think working with teachers to have them understand this ecological framework and really understand what it means, why the student isn't maybe succeeding or is misbehaving, what that really is. And I think at a teacher level, as new teachers are coming up, they really need to know all this. So if you have contact with their school of education, I think that's really one of the places that we need to get going.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Because what you say about rural is completely right. I work in a school-based center,
like in a school in a town that has school-based health center. It does not everything that you all are saying, but it's still a level 3 school, which is a school that's going to be very close. And so, even with all those resources, there's a mind, there's a parent, I don't know what it is. I want to say mindset, parenting, I don't know what it is, but in the community, just depressed mindset. I don't know how they can get out of it and how, even with all those resources, why it's still not connected. So, I was thinking like the co-op would be like for us, maybe UIC, because my school's near UIC Rush. And the referral goes straight to them. They make the appointment for all the.
When you say co-op, though, I'm sorry, what do you mean by co-op? You mean like cooperative education?
Like, we used to have Stroger, which is Cook County Hospital used to be in the school. Funding got pulled, they got pulled out of the school.
Okay.
So what you say is so on point. So there was a standalone school based health center, and then they kind of had a cooperative agreement with the university as opposed to being.
Okay.
Beholden to the university,
okay.
To kind of streamline services for the
That's what you mean by co-op?
That's what I mean by co-op.
Okay, a cooperative agreement is what you're talking about. Okay, now go back a little bit, and when you say, what about the cooperative agreement in relationship to dropout?
I'm thinking maybe that would be another way, because this school may have done a lot, so maybe at that referral part, when they're trying to get psychological services, you know, they have social work on site and trying to do deeper things, that's where there's a drop off and they have to send them to Rush. And that's when they send them to UFC.
And are you suggesting that a cooperative agreement can be helpful to the referral?
I'm thinking it could be helpful with the clinic because they could streamline right into setting up the appointment, have the relationship with the doctor, so all the parent and the child has to do is go straight there.
I think I got it now.
Yeah, I never just respond, any kind of partnership is always a two-way thing. So
that's right.
Okay, so what you would have to say to the psychiatry department is, I bet your psych residents would really like to see more adolescents. We can help you see more adolescents when you keep your psychiatry certification, and this is how we can help you do this. Because none of these places, it's got to be like, what does that institution or that school of medicine or that anybody get out of it? Or like if you have your school of education and your students need to do a project because, we can help you do that project, but we want someone to come and teach this in our health class, something like that. And then they're much more likely to do it, especially if they're forced. But that's kind of how it works because they don't do it out of goodness of their heart. They have to really see what's the advantage for them to make this contract.
Good point.
Yes.
I'm not about just health care, no.
Right.
So how in your vision does it work closely with families?
Every meeting for the school does. So there's a PTSA meeting, we're there. This Saturday there's an enrollment trip, we're going to be there. They have, last week there was an African American parent night that the school organized, we were there. So whatever the school does, we're embedded into that we're involved. We also have a youth advisory board, and that is a way that parents have been able to come to our events because the kids are involved, and the kids are the ones that are creating whatever they're working on. But right now what I'm doing that has been very effective, even more so than the parent workshop, is using team theater as a way to educate families on mental health issues. That has been, we just did form theater, type of participatory theater in the spring. That has changed my mind. It's the way to go. Get parents, get on stage, interact with students on the issues that are coming up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marcia.
Terry?
Thank you. So I think that HP 2020 gives us an opportunity to partner with education in a very demonstrable way, because high school graduation is absolutely an agenda in the education community. So what we bring to the table, as you know from public health, we know how to bring the data, bring the expertise to the table on how to analyze that data in terms of health data, and we know also how to think about effective and efficient programs that would be helpful to graduation, as well as the resources around local health departments, community health centers, and most importantly, and I can't say this enough, making sure that our health personnel has professional development in the educational lexicon, it's a whole different language, an entirely different framework, an entirely different set of dynamics, and you want to make enemies quick, go knock on their door during the time standardized testing is going on, because you didn't know when standardized testing was, right? We have to get on their wagon. They don't have to get on our wagon. The objective is in HP 2020, and we have a set of skills that we can bring to the table that will help them with graduation, and we know how to do that. That's part of what we do. So there are a few calls to actions. Leslie went over the policy pathways for collaboration between ESEA, Elementary and Secondary Education Act, that whoever becomes president, something's going to happen with it. Okay, so keep an eye out on that and how to crosswalk state education policies, federal education policies that have health implications. Identifying existing school health partnerships, and provide the needed technical and fiscal support for their ongoing work. I know the fiscal part is tricky, but what we can do is think about how to match those dollars. We can bring that expertise from the health community. And in Michigan, they're even matching education dollars, okay, as administrative match, which provides resources. Commit to more integrated practices by keeping each other informed of initiatives, funding, opportunities. It's going to take a collaboration between the health community and the education community locally. It's very local. It's not at the state level. It's not at the federal level exclusively. It has to happen locally at the district level, maybe even the community level. And then embracing the mindset that creating these partnerships is not an add-on to our existing workload, but rather a strategy to get our work done more efficiently and effectively that we're already having to do. And then, lastly, what I want to do is to see if any of you here are interested in becoming a part of a learning community around this Healthy People 2020 objective, where we could share ideas, share progress. We would use our website, which has the website address there, and share approaches similar to what was going on here in this room. Maybe consider hosting webinars. If you're doing something really well in your community, you're from California, right? Yes, you're from somewhere here in California.
Bay Area,
right, that's working really well, then you can host it, you know, for 20 or 30 minutes sharing the idea. I mean, we would host it, but you would be the expert content-wise. And we would host it, you'd be the person to provide, and share ideas at a deeper level is what we're talking about. When the material comes out next year around linking education and health data, many of you may not go to the same conferences. We don't go to the same conferences. And so, but you want to know about it. You want to be exposed to it. And yes, it'll be on our website. Keep checking that. But also to dialogue about it. You know, what's working and how did you overcome this, that, or the other thing? That kind of thing is what I think could work very well if there's interest. We don't need any more work. Trust me. You know, it's 2.5 of us. Leslie, myself, and Kelly. That's who makes up our center. But we have the technology and we have people at APHA who can help us make this happen if this is something you think would be beneficial to you, let's say over the next year, roughly. Or we can even start short. We can say 6 months, see how it goes, and then see if we need to do it again for another 6 months. If you're interested, there's a sign-up sheet somewhere. It's going around, and we will post the information on our website, and we'll start thinking about some ideas and ways that we can move forward with a learning community around every kid graduating from high school on time, as it says in Healthy People 2020. So with that, thank you for coming. We'll write this up. Thank you. we'll write this up and put it on. These are just some ideas that we can get started with. Okay. Thank you so much for coming.